what I have recognized is that these events are just not random. They're tactical interventions to create fear and division in our communities.
Hey, welcome to In the Thick. This is a podcast about politics, race, and culture from a POC perspective. I'm Maria Hinojosa.
And I'm Julio Ricardo Varela.
And joining us in our immigrant Harlem studio in person for the first time, Cristina Jimenez, Executive Director of United We Dream. Okay, Cristina, what up with the studio? It is an immigrant studio, right?
It is. Like, we're so close and cozy. Great to be here.
Cozy, meaning we're like pressed up against each other. And joining us all the way from Tucson, Arizona, is Grecia Lima. She's National Political Director of the Center for Community Change. Hey, Grecia, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you for having me.
First question right off the bat. What do you want to get off your chest, Cristina? Like, what's the thing that you just want to say?
There's so many, but one of them, actually just Monday morning, I got a message from some of our colleagues at Dream Defenders. We have been planning with them and many other young people a National Day of Action against the GEO Group. And, you know, for those of you who may know, the GEO Group is a corporation who owns many of the jails and private detention camps that are responsible and profiting from the jailing and incarceration of immigrants and people of color. And in this National Day of Action, we were planning to come together, expose what the GEO Group is responsible for, and, you know, hold them accountable and demand that elected officials stop engaging in taking funds from the corporation. So what we are hearing is that GEO Group has filed a cease and desist letter.
Dear sir, madam, we represent the GEO Group Inc., aka the Dream Killers. GEO does not play any role in determining whether a particular individual or group of individuals should or should not be detained.
Okay. So basically they're saying it's the government's fault that they do what they do.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Wow. They're claiming a defamation.
And basically what Dream Defenders is doing is telling the truth about what they do.
Exposing that they are responsible in profiting from the incarceration and the detention of people of color and immigrants. So, you know, definitely for me, this is a sign that we are shaking things and we won't stop.
Grecia, what about you? What do you want to get off your chest?
I mean, what else can I get off my chest besides just tremendous gratitude for being here, for having a conversation with you all? I think there's a lot for us to be in the know on how our families are resisting and using all their tools at their disposal to protect their families and protect their neighbors. So I'm just really, really excited to be here.
That is so great because you know what? I love starting with some gratitude, yo. Yeah. So seriously, thank you
nice.
So much. And that's good news because it means that it's just democracy in action, people engaged. Yo, we are joined by two badass Latinas who have been on the front lines of immigration and advocacy. So I just want to give you some updates on what's going on in terms of policy. So just bear with me as we go through a few of these numbers, okay? So we can't forget, first of all, that 11,000 immigrant kids are currently in black box detention centers across the country.
Yeah.
Now, we got to keep in mind that these kids who are being detained are a mix of children who were taken from in the zero tolerance policy, also children who are in family detention because it exists, also children who came on their own, kids who are called these unaccompanied minors. So all of those add up to 11,000 immigrant kids in detention. And to clarify even more, so under that zero tolerance policy, of the over 2,000 kids that the Trump administration tore apart from their parents at the border, there are still 572 that remain separated. And 410 of these children, you guys, have parents who were already deported, and the government is saying they cannot locate them. 410. And this is according to MSNBC as of Monday. All right. So in the context of all of that, on Friday, a federal judge ruled that the Trump administration must fully restore the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, that's DACA. This is the third court ruling against the Trump administration and in support of DACA. And the government has 20 days to file an appeal. But if the appeal fails, then DACA essentially has to be fully implemented again as of August 23rd. So, Cristina, United We Dream, you've been organizing for DACA so long. In fact, the last time that you were on In the Thick, Cristina, you and Julio spoke in D.C. after the government shutdown and during the National Day of Action for the DREAM Act.
We are not going to stop fighting. And we are not alone. Because look at this beautiful church.
It felt to me like there was a lot of groups that I wouldn't normally see there. So how did it feel?
It was a powerful coming together of what I would really describe as the formation of the resistance.
So now with what's happened, what do you make of this ruling? And what do you think of the future of DACA?
We are, again, in limbo. However, I think that what's important about the recent news is that now you have a third judge. And this judge, Judge Bates, actually leans a little bit more conservative on his legal analysis.
Yeah.
So now even like a conservative leaning judge, it's coming out saying the administration was wrong in terminating the DACA program, and the program, it's constitutional, and, you know, it should continue to work. So that, I think it's definitely a victory from the legal front. So now we have a third judge that it's saying that the administration is wrong. It's good on the legal front. However, what I will say is that it does not mean that new applicants could apply. It means that those who have currently DACA and could renew should definitely renew, because you still have the window of time to renew. And third, the uncertainty doesn't stop, because we know that Trump is not going to stop here. So the administration is going to definitely file something between now and August 23rd, which is the deadline that the judge has laid out. Mm. And we know that they're going to try to fight this back. All of these cases moving in the courts are all accelerating the process to get us to the Supreme Court.
One of the things that's coming out of this DACA debate, people are starting to miss the point of DACA, why it was so important. Like, it's almost becoming like its own like label. And I just want to step back for a second, Grecia, and you were a former dreamer.
Yeah.
From a personal standpoint, why is DACA so important? Like, it's become sort of this debate, but we've kind of lost the foundation of it. So why is it so important to have something like DACA in this country right now?
I was a young undocumented student in the early 2000s, and I could have never imagined that we would be discussing undocumented students or even yet defending them at the courts. I think it shows the evolution of our movement, and we're not just at the halls of Congress. We're not just at the streets. We're at the courts. We're using more tools than we had before. And that's encouraging, because the more tools at our disposal, the more allies that we're creating, the more momentum that we're building to protect not just young undocumented immigrants, because I think that's the misconception. It's actually a lot of undocumented immigrants that have now an opportunity to directly contribute into our society. One of the first times that I came out as an undocumented student, my battle cry, I guess, was let me contribute. Let me be a citizen, because I already felt like a citizen. I already felt like my family was a part of the fabric of this nation. And I just wanted to have an opportunity to put my talents and my values at work to improve our community. So I just think that it's not just a fear. It's actually a hope for the kind of country that we can build. And it's also, to me, really important to step back and look at the evolution of our movement. We're actually pushing the next frontier, which is the electoralizing our resistance. And the evolutions of our strategy is not over, that we have to build towards a new frontier of brown and black political power, manifesting our organizing capacity at the ballot box. And I feel really proud that over the last couple of years, I have been building that electoral capacity with dozens of grassroots organizations. And it will be because of all of them and all of the work that United We Dream and us, that we will achieve the highest aspiration of our democracy.
Whoa, that was...
I'm beginning to feel like, wow, it's going to be a great week. All right, man.
All right. We're going to fight back.
Saving the day in the United States of America.
Yeah, but I think the point about DACA, like, I think people are losing a little bit of the focus of the DACA benefit. So I appreciate Grecia, like, sort of giving us that historical context and knowing that this is a battle in the courtrooms. But I also think what's happening at the same time outside of the courtrooms, and Christina already kind of brought it up, is this growing opposition just to ICE and how there's mm-hmm. divesting from ICE and these private prison companies mm-hmm. like Geo Group and Core Civic yeah. that work for ICE. So around the country, you have colleges, cities, and pension funds are being pressured to cut ties with ICE and ICE-related companies.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are more than 70 organizations. They're demanding that Wells Fargo and JP Morgan stop financing these privately run ICE facilities.
Yes.
And the other thing is that if you look at the stock and the share price of these corporations, these private prison and detention industry stock prices have gone up under the Trump administration. So, Christina, this tactic, I mean, you were already kind of talking about what happened to Dream Defenders, because you're right. I mean, the Geo Group never responds to anyone. Now they come with a lawyer letter. So talk to me a little bit more about whether this strategy of going after the economics behind all this mm-hmm. is effective. And is this the next strategy for people like you or others?
You know, I think it's part of multiple strategies, Julio, that we need to be working on, because what we are going to be facing is not only, you know, termination of DACA, and potentially, you know, the reason why I'm saying like there's a still uncertainty around DACA is because the Supreme Court decision may not be favorable.
Right.
We may end up in a place where people will not be able to longer renew. So we're going to end up again in a situation where we're going to need congressional intervention to protect people from deportation. But the strategy from the administration and the people that support the administration, because, like, you know, let's be clear, it's not just about Trump. It's about governors. It's about representatives and politicians mm-hmm. and leaders in all kinds of sectors that support this, making immigrants undocumented, criminalizing them so that they can then easily incarcerate them, deport them, and, you know, get rid of our communities.
I was
like, this
say,
is what's happening.
Ethnic cleansing.
Ethnic cleansing.
I mean, at this point, it's not by death, you know. The message could not be clearer.
Yeah, and the strategy, it's very clear, right? Like determination of TPS, determination of DACA, wanting to then use the Fight for the Dream Act to get money for the border, more money for ICE facilities and detention camps and
less numbers of refugees, legal immigrants.
Exactly.
Everything is being curtailed.
So their strategy is clear, right? So
right.
The very nativist white supremacist strategy is very clear. So this is why, Julio, to your point, we need multiple strategies, because on one hand, we need to make sure that Congress, because it's the only body with power that can actually stop this madness, needs to intervene and provide a solution where people are protected from deportation so that the threat of deportation goes away. And also so that the act of migration is no longer a crime. Because, you know, a lot of what we're facing right now is the impact of the 1996 laws, where my parents coming here seeking a better life.
Mm-hmm.
The act of seeking a better life for your family, or the act of seeking refuge or asylum, is a crime.
And that we love to remind our dear listeners, because they appreciate the fact that we talk about this complexity, was signed into law when we had a Democratic president named Bill Clinton, and the Democrats controlled the House and the Senate
yes.
at that point.
Exactly.
And we need to continue to hit the streets as we have been doing, and, you know, that won't stop. But we also need to target other enablers. So this is where the corporations and people who support making businesses with, like, Geo Group and others who are benefiting from the incarceration and detention of immigrants mm-hmm. is another key.
I just wanted to add that as someone that I had to endure the unfortunate experience of fighting the unfair detention and deportation of my father, I really appreciate that campaign that is putting the center, the profit making of these companies from the detention, deportation of Black and brown bodies. It is not an experience that I wish upon anyone. And I did experience a lot of heartache, but I also experienced a lot of community solidarity and ultimately victory. But I don't shy away from the fact that the forces that racially profile and criminalize our communities and immigrants were built in the image and foundation of the forces that have separated, criminalized, and killed innumerable Black families. So I just think it's important for us to continue to say that because we're not alone in this fight. Mm-hmm. There's actually a historical perspective
right.
on how all Black American families have been fighting to keep their families together, and that we have to join those two campaigns and we have to join those two forces.
I would also add Indigenous people.
Yes.
But, you know, of course, I agree with you, Grecia. It's really important to recognize that this is centered on anti-Black hatred.
Yeah.
The hatred of Black bodies.
Mm-hmm.
So much of it which actually leads us into our next, well, our next point of discussion, because it was almost a year ago that white supremacists took to the streets in Charlottesville, Virginia, staging those violent rallies that left one counter-protester dead. This past weekend in Portland, Oregon, far-right groups, Patriot Prayer and the Proud Boys, led a rally with threats of violence.
We're in downtown Portland, where we've been following members of Antifa that have just marched down here to meet up with members of Patriot Prayer.
Proud Boys, off our trees, fashion, retreat.
However, police here are not taking any chances on this. They are dressed in their SWAT gear. They have said, we are not messing around.
And you know, this is why we love In the Thick producers, because they give us all of this really important data. So listen to this. It's interesting because Portland has its own history of white supremacy, and it often really gets lost behind this image of kind of, you know, Portlandia and really progressive. But remember, before Oregon became a state, as a territory in 1844, it ordered all the black people to leave. And if they refused, they'd be whipped every 6 months until they left. This is actual American history. Then in 1859, Oregon joined the Union as a white-only state. And I mean, you know, all of this was after the genocide of indigenous peoples. In fact, Portland still is one of the whitest cities, with 80% white residents and a disproportionately small immigrant and POC population because of this racist history. And that's just a little glimpse of Oregon's history. But in Portland, this past Saturday, right-wing protesters and anti-fascist counter-protesters clashed. Al Jazeera reported that more than 1,000 counter-protesters outnumbered the hundreds of far-right protesters, and that the police targeted the anti-fascist counter-protesters, claiming that they had weapons. And this, despite the fact that one of the lead right-wing rally organizers, Joey Gibson, was bragging beforehand that they were going to bring guns to the march.
I can't think of one rally where we did not have guns with us. I mean, we always have guns. Even when we're not at rallies, everywhere we go, we have guns. I mean, everyone should be carrying around guns at all times, especially people in our situation. I think it's easy for people in Portland to freak out, especially if you cover your face and your biggest weapon is a pole and you don't know what it's like to be a real American and to have guns and to go shoot guns.
At least 4 people were arrested, but it was not a repeat of Charlottesville. However, far-right groups do plan to hold a Unite the Right 2 in Washington, D.C. on August 12th, which does mark the one-year anniversary of Charlottesville. So, Grecia and Cristina, as organizers, what do you think is the best way to actually deal with violent opposition or the fact that white supremacy is increasingly becoming more public? Like, how do you deal with that as an organizer? Cristina?
I think that this is one showing a couple of things, that the current environment is definitely supporting the outright violence, attacked, white supremacist expression in many, many forms. Not because it has not existed, it's been there, but like now you can see it more. I mean, even just from looking at how much hate I get on my Twitter account, right? Second, I also think it's backlash of the work that we're doing. It's backlash to the power of the movements that, you know, we are part of and that we have been engaging in for many years, whether you see that as the movement for Black Lives, whether you see that at the immigrant justice movement, whether you see that now growing movement against gun violence led by young people. And, you know, the very remarkable part of all of this is that young people are leading in all of these many fronts.
Yeah.
So as an organizer, I, quite frankly, I think about we are the majority. And when I say we are the majority, I'm referring to people who disagree with the values and the vision of white supremacists that are driving things like what happened in Charlottesville and what happened in Portland. So for me, this is a huge and unprecedented opportunity. The backlash and the very clear and direct opposition and attack is also giving us an opportunity as movement builders and organizers to tap into the power of the unorganized to organize them, but also making the connections, right? Like the fact that we're having a conversation about the connections of the systems and the laws that are impacting Native American communities or that have historically impacted communities of color, and that we're lifting up those connections. We weren't doing this 10 years ago.
True, true.
You're absolutely right.
And what do you do, Grecia, as an organizer?
first of all, we can't take those threats lightly. And we also can't underestimate the power that our opposition has, especially like Christina just mentioned, white supremacists taking to the streets. So for me, I try to analyze why this is happening at that moment. And what I have recognized is that these events are just not random. They're tactical interventions to create fear and division in our communities. Just like we saw in Charlottesville that white supremacists took to the streets before crucial gubernatorial and state legislature elections, we're seeing the same playbook being tried again in Oregon, but this time with a critical ballot initiative, a play which is Measure 105. So Oregon is also one of the states that has the longest standing sanctuary city law. And this measure 105 actually is trying to throw out Oregon's existing sanctuary law that has been protecting Oregonians from unfair racial profiling for more than 30 years. And whether people were in the streets, whether they were at their homes, whether, you know, they didn't get a chance to be in the streets because of fear of the type of violence that these groups are intervening, they will actually have an opportunity to say, you know what? This activity, this action doesn't define my state. My state is going to get defined by my values, by my voice at the ballot box. Our communities are responding and showing that they're going to protect each other and they're not going to let them intimidate them.
Hey, we're back and you're listening to In the Thick. I'm Maria Hinojosa. With me is my co-host, Julio Ricardo Varela. We're joined this week by Cristina Jimenez and Grecia Lima. Let's get back to the conversation.
One of the things that you guys both mentioned, the threat and divide and the fear that you're seeing in these protests, and Grecia, how you're saying you got to have to take it seriously. At the same time, you have media journalists that sort of help perpetuate the dangers of that division. And I have to bring up
one
most irresponsible, dangerous so-called reporting by Terrence McCoy in the Washington Post last week that was called White and in the Minority. It was basically a story of these two young white workers in rural Pennsylvania that work for a chicken plant where they're literally the minority. Everyone else is Puerto Rican or Dominican, and Latino Rebels published this group editorial because, you know, the feeling was raw. We saw a lot of reaction. And one of the things that came out of that was that how that Washington Post article perpetuates white fear. And it was only humanizing the white only couple. And one of my favorite lines from the editorial, it was like a bad John Hughes movie that all of a sudden the Latino workers were all sort of these zombies that were afraid of the threat. And that's the type of thing that these white supremacists latch onto in these protests, right? That they say, well, what about the poor little 20-year-old white worker in the chicken plant in rural Pennsylvania?
Who doesn't speak Spanish and therefore doesn't have any friends.
Go to Duolingo. It's free.
Not only that, Julio, but the assumption that no one in that plant speaks English is a bunch of bullshit.
Oh, my God.
And so it's like, oh, I do believe that the role of journalists is, in fact, to put ourselves into the shoes of someone, right?
Right.
So I can appreciate the reporter putting themselves into the shoes of this one white woman who's like, God, I mean, I'm like the only one at this chicken processing plant and it's no fun. But it was the way, it was the tone, it was the dehumanization. It was like, have they ever done a story of being the only Spanish speaking person or like anybody? Like, what is that like? What do you feel? How's you've never seen that story ever at all. So, okay, so as organizers, because the journalists, we could go on and on, but as organizers, Cristina and Grecia, what do you got to say about this? Because how do we combat these narratives?
I mean, honestly, I had to check and see if this was not in the opinion section for a little while. I was like, wait, is this in the opinion section? What is happening?
Same.
Even just thinking about what Maria, what you just mentioned, replace the protagonists. And make that a young fourth grade student going through the school system in Pennsylvania, and you have the same narrative. You could almost have like point by point the fear, the isolation, the lack of opportunity, the lack of access. Like, why would this reporter actually not take a step back and say, hey, what are the mechanisms at play that led you to this moment? So it's like, why couldn't we get a context about how the system is failing these two economically disadvantaged white people? I mean, it's just like Americans are waking up to the fact that a few people, corporate lobbies, politicians, and others are fabricating kickbacks and policies that benefit the over-rich. So when the inevitable outcome of such policies is a failure to create like shared economic prosperity, they turn around and point the finger to our communities, to immigrants, to Black, to the poor. So it's like, okay, fine, let's set aside the fact that this is a reporting or, you know, whatever we are calling that, that it just, for me, it was just a straightforward human interest story. Can we at least address the misguided framework of victimhood and division, regardless of who's your protagonist? It just, I was stunned.
Yeah, yo, that's why
boom.
Futuro Media, the company that I started just over 8 years ago, we do not use the term minority in any of our reporting because we know, right?
Exactly.
White people were then going to become a minority. It's like going to happen. So we as a media company said no.
Right.
So the whole premise on which the Washington Post went after this was just like, y'all.
You know, I had a similar reaction where I was like, well, this is an opinion piece because
this is a style piece.
You know, like, yeah, I just like I just don't consider this serious reporting. I really don't. It wasn't because he's not really asking the why questions and he's not really covering the who. You know, like how reporters, you know, in my 101, my 101, you know, journalism class, you know, the five W's, who, what, where, right? So the unfortunate part from my perspective is that he's not the only one writing pieces like this.
Exactly.
Well, he's got editors.
Okay. Right. Most so you have an entire
senior editors.
Exactly.
In most of these places we know, sadly, majority white.
And men.
Yeah. Because then my question is like, who approved this? How many more people read this? Because I know that there's an editorial process before it actually goes to publish.
Right.
They could have just sent another reporter to do that same story, same place, different family, you know, and then have that family be like, híjole, pues no. Entonces, you know, like we go by the groceries and they yell at us because we don't speak English perfectly. You know what I'm saying? Anything.
I mean, it happens everywhere. The hospital, the school, when you walk in the street, when you're going to church, it just happens everywhere. And so, and
who cares how Latinos feel? Come on, stop complaining, coño.
It also misses a complete analysis of just like what racism is.
Yeah.
Right? Because for racism to exist, you need a power dynamic. It's not just about the color of your skin. It's about a power dynamic and who has more privilege and power set up by the system. And also who are the other enablers or characters or entities responsible for what we are, for what's happening to many communities in rural areas, whether that's employers, elected officials,
right,
companies that are profiting.
But the oversimplification of the Latino population in Pennsylvania, where you start mixing Puerto Ricans and Dominicans and Mexican immigrants.
Exactly.
And it becomes sort of the Trump narrative.
Exactly.
When someone
they're
like Terrence McCoy is like, dude, it's Pennsylvania. Have you been to Philadelphia? That's the most Boricua city going. People have moved to rural Pennsylvania. And it's like you lost an entire context of what it is to be of the Latino Northeast experience because you need to lump it all into this Trump white fear narrative. And then the Washington Post is like, yeah, that sounds good. I think it's bullshit.
And, you know, there's this other narrative, right, which was not mentioned in this piece, which, again, given the photo in this piece of a Confederate flag at a house in Pennsylvania, in that Pennsylvania town.
Yeah.
So just a little bit of context in terms of Pennsylvania. As of 2017, in the state, there were 40 different hate groups, many of them with white supremacist roots, like the KKK. And that's according to the Southern Poverty Law Center. And you guys, it's the fifth most active state for white supremacy behind California, Florida, Texas, and New York. God, what do all of those states have in common? A lot of Latinos and people of color. But as Cristina says, in reference to this, where was the reporting?
And this is why I appreciate so much the work that the two of you do and many of the colleagues that you work with, because we actually need more of that. And I know that in an environment where the administration is also creating so much fear and targeting the media, I mean, calling them like the enemies.
You mean like...
I mean, did you see that whole exchange between CNN?
Dude! No. I mean, it's like equally.
And the press secretary, right?
So he hates because I'm Mexican. He hates because I'm an immigrant. He hates because I'm a woman. He hates because I'm a journalist. It's like, equally, man.
So we need journalists to do their job for the sake of our democracy. And I understand in the context of growing fear and targeting, but it's just even more essential to call the integrity of the reporting and call things what they are.
Hmm. Yeah.
And you know what? Places like the Washington Post, the New York Times, which I love.
Yeah.
Please do your work in diversifying your senior staff. Senior. Yes. Entry. That's
editorial
great.
Editorial room.
Senior editorial, senior editors, assignment editors. Do that work, because you lose credibility and we can't afford to have you losing credibility at this point.
Right.
We've been talking a lot about the midterms, right? So right now, there's a lot of concern about the vulnerability to the entire system in terms of Russian influence. I would love paper ballots myself. I just love paper ballots. There's a lot of concern around POC people being purged from the voting rolls. Grecia, you're part of the Unite the Vote campaign, which is mobilizing infrequent voters in communities of color across the country to vote this November. So just give us a quick wrap up of what is this campaign?
Yeah, well, Firm Action, which is a network of more than 20 grassroots immigrant rights organizations, we launched the Unite the Vote campaign. And it is because we are tired of hearing the type of narrative of division and fear that we want to showcase the best traits of the human spirit, which is solidarity, collective ingenuity to create a better future for all of us. So with thousands of person-to-person conversations with voters at their homes and their phones, over text message, over digital, mandándoles señales de humo, however we can, we're going to talk to people. We're going to talk to them and we're going to share with them the vision that we have for the country that we're fighting for. And we're trying to make a very specific contribution to the congressional district strategy. One is because a lot of the voters that live inside of our organizations, that are part of members of our organizations, have overlap in these competitive districts that have a very small margin of victory, and that we believe their Latino and immigrant voters are going to be the deciding factor, whether they're showing up at the polls or making their voices heard, they will be the deciding factor in contributing to some of this victory. So we know that we can make that contribution. And not only that, we're overlaying that strategy with other important things that are happening besides the congressional district. So we're overlaying gubernatorial races, attorney general races, local city council elections, because we know that for us to be able to influence and build the type of political power that we want for those organizations to have, we have to overlay all strategies. So I feel really proud of the fact that we're building in the capacity for grassroots organizations that are member-based, member-led, for them to have that interjection and opportunity of building political power that is independent of candidates, independent of the party, because they will not go away on election day. So I'm really excited for the midterm elections. I'm really excited for the type of energy that we're seeing. So I think we're going to see a very different narrative, and all those white supremacists better be running, because we're coming.
You mean running like jogging, not like running for office?
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. Running away from us, because we're going to take this ballot.
Jogging. Okay, Cristina, I know you love the midterms.
Look, this work, it's so exciting, actually.
I love it. Latinas getting excited about electoral politics.
This is awesome.
This is the test for our movements, not just the immigrant community or the Latinx community. So imagine the power of all those people that have joined in action in their city, in their community, in their state, showing up to the polls. I think about two things. Number one, at the state level, we ought to make sure, knowing that this administration may stay in place for the full term, that states can do a lot to defend our communities and to ensure that all of our communities can live safe and without fear and where we can all thrive. And that means immigrants, Muslims, the LGBT community, Black communities, refugee communities, etc. So gubernatorial races are going to be key. State races in places like Texas, New Mexico, and other states will be key. So your vote is going to matter because governors and state legislatures can make decisions about, for example, breaking contracts with ICE, not sharing information with the federal government so the federal government can hunt immigrants down, can provide driver's licenses. Hey, my dad is an undocumented worker whose driver's license will be huge protection for him. Right. He drives every day without a license for work, right? So there's so much that we could do at the state level. So I'm just trying to lay out, like, what's at stake for our people in these elections? It's not just because voting, it matters because of our democracy and the health of our democracy. Yes, but it matters because actually our lives could change. The lives of our communities could change because all of this is at stake. And then at the national level, for me, success will be ensuring, and this is not just about getting Democrats to take the House, as many of you probably hear. It's about candidates who actually commit to stopping this administration on all fronts. And for our communities, we are going to be, you know, endorsing, supporting candidates and mobilizing our communities for the issues that matter to us.
Okay, so let's move on to our final segment, Temperature Check, which is a moment to talk about how we're feeling during these intense times. And I wanted to talk about what happened last week in Allentown, Pennsylvania. A Latino man was killed by police. His name was Joey Santos. He was from New Jersey, and he was in the area at a theme park with his family. Allegedly, he was vandalizing cars, according to witnesses, when he was stopped by the police, and he was shot multiple times. There were videos on the internet. And then although at first the local police decided to not identify the officer who's on paid leave, but then on Tuesday, the Lehigh County District Attorney charged the officer, Jonathan Roselli, with voluntary manslaughter. Roselli's still on paid leave. And according to witnesses, Santos, during the altercation, he was actually asking for help and actually said, "Don't do it," to Roselli. Now, according to the district attorney, Roselli, he's been patrolling on his own for only 5 months. And get this, he allegedly said that he fucked up when he was talking to the first responders after the shooting.
Right. And this kind of stuff just keeps happening. This Thursday marks 4 years since Michael Brown was gunned down by police in Ferguson, Missouri. And now Joey Santos joins the list of POC murdered by the police. So to the both of you, a temperature check. How are you guys feeling about this violence and the fact that it just feels like it's always been there, but it's creeping, right? Grecia, we'll start with your temperature check about violence and how it's impacting the lives of people of color.
It's really hard to put into words the knot in my stomach that I feel every time that I hear of another name of a young person or any person of color being persecuted, killed in terrible, horrible ways. Because I think of it almost as a rock dropping in the pond. And the multitude of waves that it creates for a community, for a family, the pain that it causes, and that it just expands and expands and expands and expands. And unless there's an intervention, like another rock that is being thrown in the lake that counteracts that wave, that kind of pain and hate just keeps on expanding in a community, in a family, in a state, in a city. So to me, I try to ground myself on how am I the antidote to that hate? How are we the antidote to that hate? There's a really good quote that I hear from a lot of friends and people in the movement that say, heal people, heal hurt people hurt.
Hmm.
And I think, first of all, we all have to do our own work to heal and to push for transformational interventions that are not perpetuating the trauma of our communities, but are actually asking us to be a better version of ourselves so that we can then communicate that to others. So I feel so hard for the families that are experiencing this. And I also have a lot of hope, because what I have seen is Black mothers especially turn around with all their pain, with all their heartache. I'm sorry, just get really emotional with this. With all their pain, with all their heartache, turn around and be beacons of hope and beacons of solidarity and forge this powerful path to justice for all of us. So we gotta show up, we gotta intervene, and we can't let that pawn, that first rock, be the last rock. We have to be writing the next chapter of solidarity, of community, of justice with one another, starting with us.
Mm, okay.
Hey.
All right. Usually I'm trying to make people cry, but all right. She made me cry. She just made me cry.
Wow.
Christina.
Yeah, that was really powerful. Thank you for your words. You know, I think for me, it's really about transformation. What holds me up in these moments of, you know, true just indignation, because these are people's lives. And, you know, every time something happens, particularly to a young person of color, I think about my brother who's 24 and who's brown and male and walking in the streets, who at the age of 10 was a stop and frisk by NYPD and assaulted. And there was no accountability. And all he was doing was just walking home from school. So, you know, and like that, we just have many folks in our communities who are at constant risk. And you often wonder, my loved one could be next. Mm-hmm. And so I think for me, those moments of indignation really turn into transformative conversations, because, you know, let's recognize in our own communities, when somebody gets shot, especially by police, the question is like, oh, ¿qué hicieron?
Mm-hmm. Exacto.
Hicieron algo mal, right? Well, they did something wrong.
Siempre.
Even with Joey, there's a question of whether or not he was doing something. But the point is that do our lives mean so little that exactly. If the guy is breaking an antenna off a car, that the police have to shoot him multiple times?
Or like the Black teenager, you know, in Pennsylvania running away from the traffic stop right when the vehicle was stopped.
Right. That's what happened to Antoine Rose Jr., who was at a traffic stop. And police were there, and he ran away from police. And then he was shot 3 times by a Pittsburgh area cop, killing him.
But here's the thing. So for me, when I'm able to have conversations with people in the community about something like this and really ask the question and get a lot of the anti-Blackness, but also internalized hate and racism in our communities that comes from our history of, you know, colonialism. I mean, when you really get to deconstruct that and people in our community start having an aha moment or an awakening moment about the value of our lives and that it doesn't matter what you do, our community should not support and or enforce or try to justify why police or why Border Patrol shot a woman to death, a Guatemalan young woman at the border, right? So I think for me, what holds me up is when I have conversations like that with the community and I see moments of awakening and in transformation that we just need to constantly have with our friends, with our family, with our community, so that that true liberation that we're seeking in a lot of the organizing work that we do, we can really and truly achieve together. And, you know, the last thing for me is that action matters so much. So in moments of indignation, and I can have conversations about transformation, there also needs to be action.
Uno, dos, tres.
Cristina Jimenez, Executive Director of United We Dream, and Grecia Lima, National Political Director for the Center for Community Change. Two badass Latinas just like rocking our world right here on In the Thick. Thanks to the both of you for joining us on In the Thick.
So grateful and so thankful to have joined you.
Same. Thank you so much for having us.
I'm Maria Hinojosa.
And I'm Julio Ricardo Varela.
And remember, dear listener, go to Apple Podcasts to rate and review us, especially after such an amazing episode like this one, because it really helps other listeners to find us. And also follow us on Twitter and Instagram at In the Thick Show, and look for us and like us on Facebook. And as I said, it's all about word of mouth, so tell everybody that you know to listen to In the Thick. In the Thick is produced by Juan Pablo Garnham, Stephanie LeBeau, and Nicole Rothwell. Our theme music is Comencemos by Jungle Fire. The music that you heard is courtesy of Nacional, Kep, and ZZK Records. We'll see you on the next edition of In the Thick. And I just want to say, dear listener, thank you so much for choosing to listen to our podcast.
Ciao.
Until next time. We talk all kinds of fun shit and then we make you cry.
That's such a winning tagline. You laugh and then
we
you cry.
We should have a tequila this place, you know, in the Trump years. I'm telling you.
Take that, Mr. Trump. We start every day with a shot of tequila, cabrón. Oh, boy. Too bad I don't drink. No tomo.
Yeah.